Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Politics Ohio, our weekly series road trip, and producer Eileen LeBlanc take us to Maria Stein in Mercer County. We'll talk with the Air Force Institute of Technology's new civilian chancellor, Dr. Todd Stewart, and plenty more on the way. Up first, to help fight prescription drug abuse, the state of Ohio is making dozens of drop-off boxes available to Ohio counties for the collection of prescription drugs. To talk about this new program, we spoke with Marcy Seidel with the Drug-Free Action Alliance.
Drug-Free Action Alliance is a statewide nonprofit that focuses on the prevention of substance abuse. And one of our strategies in prevention is what's called environmental. When you take away the access to a substance, the use of that substance goes down. That's a proven scientific fact that we've learned, that you need to take away the access. So this is exactly playing into the prevention piece, in that when we get rid of those drugs that are out there for the potential to be used and abused and get them off the street and get them in some place where they cannot be obtained, then you, in fact, get the use of that particular drug to go down.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about what the new program is.
What we've done, we've partnered with the Ohio Department of Health and the Attorney General's Office to come up with these disposable drop boxes. And what it is that when people almost, I would say, I believe the statistic is that 3 out of 4 individuals who are prescribed a prescription medication legitimately don't ever really finish it. They have plenty of pills left over, and they end up sitting in people's medicine cabinets or in their kitchen counters. So what this does is allows it to be disposed of promptly and quickly by these drop box locations and gets them out of the house. Now, I know there's a lot of people that say, well, why can't we just flush them and it'll be gone? Well, these are the types of medications that we don't want in our water system, and we're finding that there's too many medications in our water system. So we want to dispose of them properly and permanently so that they cannot get into people's hands. And these drop boxes will allow that to happen.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the environmental concern. These medicines are typically ending up in the water supply or in the aquifers or places we don't want them.
Absolutely. And we are a society now of medication, so there's a huge potential of finding this in the water system. In fact, there's been some testing that's been done over the last few years where they've tested it and decided this is not the proper way for us to get rid of our medications. We really need to get rid of them in another environmentally safe way.
Water has actually been designated as a precious resource, specifically here in the Miami Valley, as it is everywhere. But this program is also focusing on Southern Ohio.
Right. The problem and the concern that we have is this is definitely a problem throughout all communities in the state of Ohio. But we do know that in southeast Ohio, it's really the epicenter of the real problem in Ohio and even nationally. We've taken a look at the statistics about the number of overdoses and the rate of use and the number of pill mills that have grown in the southeast Ohio, and we've decided this is an area where we needed to focus to start this program. You have to start somewhere. So logistically, we're looking at how we get this program started into where it will make the most difference and save the most lives, and where we can easily track what's going on to make sure that it's a sound program. And then from that information that we gather and by doing this particular program, we have every hope that at some point in time we can expand it to other parts of the state. But you have to start somewhere. So we picked the area that we thought was in the most need.
It's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but counties will need to apply for this program. Is that correct?
Yes. And it has to go through the law enforcement, because law enforcement are the ones that have to be able to maintain and manage these collection points. So an email and our notice has gone to all the, in these counties that have been identified, have gone to those law enforcement agencies. They then can apply. There's a system in which they can apply online for it, and if there are more applications than there are boxes available, then there's a criteria that will be set in place that we will examine where the need is the greatest, and we will go ahead and distribute them that way.
And do you think there's any need for people to respond to their local county health agencies and try and encourage them to participate, or do you think that participation is going to be there?
We think the participation will be there, but actually we work with coalitions. Drug Free Action Alliance works with coalitions throughout all the state of Ohio, and one of the coalitions that does extremely good work in Butler County, for example, decided that they wanted to learn a little bit more about this, and I encouraged them to contact their law enforcement agencies to see if their law enforcement agency would be interested in applying for it, and then to express the interest of partnering with their law enforcement agency as well. So that's what I would encourage people to do, is to contact their law enforcement agencies to see if they are, in fact, applying for it and how they can be an advocate or, and a helpmate in this process with law enforcement.
Marcy, any final comments?
No, other than to say that this is an extreme problem that we are concerned about. Our goal is to save lives, to get prescription drugs and other medications off the street so they don't get into the hands of young people or of people who are abusing these substances. And once we do that, it's a small step, but it is an important step into keeping people healthy and away from the abuse of these types of drugs.
Marcy Seidel with the Drug Free Action Alliance. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
Ohio has been cracking down on shady doctors and pharmacists who have run pill mills and improperly distribute addictive pain medicine. With that source of illegal prescription medicine drying up, Ohio's attorney general believes that addicts and profiteers will now turn to another setting to get their meds, nursing homes. State House correspondent Bill Cohen filed this report.
This is an underreported problem, but it goes on, and we need the public's help.
Attorney General Mike DeWine is asking Ohioans with relatives or friends in nursing homes to report suspicions about prescription meds being swiped by nursing home workers. He says the thefts have already happened. He cites a recent case in a Pomeroy nursing home.
A hidden camera recorded three nurses stealing prescription drug pain patches, flu vaccines, prescription pain pills, and antibiotic creams. All three nurses were convicted of theft.
The hidden camera installed in that supposedly secure medicine room caught the thieves red-handed. Christine Hensel of the AG's office narrates some of the incriminating video.
Here she goes over and steals about an inch-sized pack of Lidoderm patches, which is a pain patch. And she takes those, as you can see, and places those in her backpack.
Attorney General DeWine recounts another case in a central Ohio nursing home. There, Timothy Tyler, who was being rehabilitated after pancreas surgery, actually helped blow the whistle on a nursing aide who'd turned thief.
He had his pain patches taken off of him, ripped off of him, by a state-tested nursing assistant. And this occurred not just once, but numerous times. Finally, one day, Mr. Tyler got so upset that he chased this nurse down.
Tyler describes the tussle he had with the nursing aide.
She took it off of me. I said, oh, no, you're not the nurse. The nurse is the only one that takes that patch. I fought her for when I was in the chair there, and she said she's going to take it down to the nurse. And I said, we'll both take it down to the nurse. Like I say, I got that feeding tube off of me, and I fought her again for it. And then I got the patch from her, and she and got the door open, and she was long gone.
After that event, the sheriff was called in. The nursing aide was later charged and convicted. Attorney General DeWine says the theft of prescription meds inside nursing homes is bad in several ways. It feeds addictions, it costs the Medicaid system that taxpayers pay for, and it leaves nursing home patients without the meds they need. He's now offering investigative help to nursing homes that suspect they have a drug theft problem, and he's telling them they're supposed to report their suspicions.
Within the next several days, we will begin sending letters to every care facility administrator in the state to remind them of their obligation to report suspected cases of abuse and neglect.
The reaction from Ohio's nursing home industry?
I don't think that anyone is going to be jumping to install hidden cameras.
The State House lobbyist for 500 homes, Pete Van Runkle, says it's fine to remind the homes about their legal responsibility, but they're already well aware of it. He says anti-theft safeguards are already in place.
Skilled nursing facilities are a very supervised environment. There are a lot of people who are involved in overseeing the daily delivery of care, and it's not easy for someone to steal medication. It can happen, but there are a lot of eyes looking at it. There's a lot of record keeping that's required, counting of the drugs, and so forth.
Still, Attorney General DeWine says his investigators, lawyers, and equipment are standing by.
Our Medicaid fraud unit is here to help.
Bill Cohen at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
This is WISO Weekend on WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. In our weekly series Road Trip, radio producers from around the state take you on audio tours from the new Ohio Guide. This week, we explore the land of the cross-tipped churches, and WYSO producer Eileen LeBlanc takes us to Maria Stein in Mercer County.
There's a section of northwest Ohio where the flat, rich farmland is poked by a series of church steeples, like pushpins marking places on a map. The churches are topped by Catholic crosses, as they were built by a sweeping German Catholic immigration, which began back in the 1830s. Here in Mercer County, the Convent of Maria Stein is the heart of it all. Built by Father Francis de Sales Brunner in 1846, the bishop in Cincinnati at the time was looking for a German-speaking priest to minister to the growing German Catholic population. Sister Barbara Ann Hoyne.
The making of vestments was one of the ways that we supported ourselves, and they designed the symbols and transferred them onto the material after they punched holes in the paper, the thin paper, and then transferred it onto the material with that blue stuff.
Father Brunner originally thought that support for the convents could come from begging, but Ohio wasn't having that. So he bought land, recruited young women from Europe, and built self-sufficient enclaves separately for men and women. Maria Stein, which sits on 60 acres of land near St. John's, became the mother house of the Sisters of the Precious Blood. The sisters farmed, made shoes and delicate lace. They supplied many churches with papier-mâché statues that look like stone sculptures. Sister Barbara Ann shows us metal presses used for making the wafer-like hosts, which are used in the Catholic Mass during communion.
It's like a little waffle on your...
It is.
So how would you make the batter for hosts?
Pretty much flour and water. I did not know how, but that's the
unleavened
formula.
Bread.
Unleavened bread, flour and water.
The convent had 200 sisters at its height between 1910 and 1920. There are four here now. Most of the sisters are retired, and the order has diminished to a great degree, as have many religious orders. There's a Hall of Fame within Maria Stein. It's a bit unsettling, slightly stunning, eerie, and inspiring, the Shrine of the Holy Relics.
In the church family, what belonged to a holy person has value to me as sharing that faith and wanting to be where they already are.
There are 1,000 relics here now, the second largest collection in the U.S. Relics are mainly small pieces of bone from the saint, but there are also full bones and one full body is represented.
One that I like always to point out is the relic of the True Cross, which is up there behind the glass in between the angels. That is a splinter-size relic of the cross on which Christ died.
The Shrine of the Holy Relics at Maria Stein is open to the public, and Sister Barbara Ann Hoyne says many come, sit, pray, and leave, and are never counted among the 25,000 organized groups which visit each year. I'm Eileen LeBlanc.
You can download the new Ohio Guide tours at seeohiofirst.org. The new Ohio Guide is produced by the Ohio Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. This is WISO Weekend. The Ohio National Guard will be sending 80 medical workers to Springfield on July 28th and 29th. WYSO's Wayne Baker reports the workers are part of the annual Guard Care program that provides free medical services to Ohio residents.
Leslie Wade with the Clark County Combined Health District says the two-day program offers medical and dental help to residents regardless of their income level and whether or not they have insurance. She hopes area residents will take advantage of the rare opportunity to get free health care.
We're doing everything we can to get the word out because preventative care is important and a lot of people do not have access.
One county each summer is selected to host the event, and this is the first time Springfield will participate. The Ohio Department of Health made the decision after noting that 15% of local residents are uninsured, and a large amount of Clark County's population doesn't have a primary doctor. With the Affordable Health Care Act taking a front seat in this year's presidential election, Wade says a nice component about the Guard Care program is that it allows residents with pre-existing conditions to attend.
They are welcome, and what we're working to do is work with local physicians and even out of county to see if we can refer them on.
Congress started the Guard Care program in 1995 with the idea of using the National Guard to provide services to cities and towns that are medically underserved. The Clark County Health District is expecting anywhere from 300 to 800 people to turn out for the event at the district's Home Avenue location, and they say no ID or medical records will be needed to get services. For WISO, I'm Wayne Baker reporting.
In May of this year, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base announced that Dr. Todd Stewart would become the first civilian chancellor of the Air Force Institute of Technology. Dr. Stewart served 34 years in the military, and at one time he was an associate professor of management at AFIT while serving in the Air Force. He retired in April of 2002 as a major general. As Dr. Stewart explains, the decision to insert a civilian chancellor to head AFIT is the result of some restructuring by the Department of Defense.
The previous Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, Dr. Gates, did a very comprehensive initiative to realign resources within the Department of Defense. About $100 billion worth of resources were realigned. In the process of that, they eliminated a number of general officer positions from within the respective military services. In some cases, disestablished organizations. In other cases, recombined them with other units. In the process of that much larger, more comprehensive initiative, one of the decisions taken was to convert the military general officer position that had been referred to as a commandant here at the Air Force Institute of Technology to a civilian senior executive position. And in the process, the term chancellor was coined.
And so tell us about the work you're doing. You're fresh on the job.
Sure. The Air Force Institute of Technology does a number of things. It manages graduate education, master's degrees and PhDs for Air Force officers and civilians primarily, as well as some members of the other military services and some international officers. Here at Wright-Patterson, on our resident campus, we host about 800 to 850 students every year studying in various programs, mostly technical and engineering programs. In addition, AFIT also manages graduate education for students the Air Force needs to send to school to study in areas not offered here at Wright-Patterson. We send about 2,500 students to civilian universities around the country to study things like medicine, law, and other technical areas that we don't offer here on the resident campus. Now, in addition to our graduate programs, AFIT also has two schools that offer continuing education courses in the areas of system acquisition, logistics, and civil engineering. And collectively, we serve about 35,000 students a year in these continuing education programs.
Logistically, that's a challenge.
It is, but we've got a great staff here. We have currently, anyway, a little bit more than 500 people, faculty and staff, who deliver these programs, and they're very good at what they do.
You have also commented on the challenging fiscal environment of the Department of Defense. So how does that play into your work there?
Well, it's, as with the rest of the Department of Defense, in fact, the federal government, it is a big challenge. Right now, with our, if I can use the term, gridlock in Congress, and ability to, at least so far, not resolve our budget deficit thing and meet the goals that were set forth in the 2011 Budget Control Act, there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of the Department of Defense, in terms of the resources that we will have available. One of the provisions of the Budget Control Act is something called sequester, and that would take effect in January of 2013, and that would be devastating. It's an across-the-board cut to federal programs. As part of the Control Act, the Department of Defense has already had to reduce its operations by $487 billion over 10 years. If sequester is triggered in January, that would almost double it, and then it would be hugely devastating to America's military. If those kinds of things were triggered. And so it becomes very difficult to plan a way forward with that kind of uncertainty. And so we have to do the best we can and assume or hope that Congress will do its work and find a way to resolve the budget issue so that that provision in the law is not activated. And so we're looking at ways in which we can continue to deliver our programs of teaching and research here at AFIT, within constraints that we have in funding and manpower and so forth. We think, I'm fairly optimistic that we can continue to grow and thrive despite the fiscal climate if we adopt different business models than perhaps we've done in the past, and that means we have to look for different sources of revenue. In some cases, that may require changes in the law, but we write law every year, so that's not an impossible task. But the resource issue is certainly the dominant factor as we try to craft a way forward.
You mentioned other sources of revenue. Can you give me some examples?
Last year, actually a little before then, Congress gave us a very limited authority to enroll employees of defense industries here at AFIT. Prior to that time, our student enrollment was limited to military people as well as federal civil service employees. This authority would give us the opportunity to enroll people in our various programs, well, and specifically in our graduate program. For example, employees that work for companies like Boeing and Northrop and Lockheed and so forth, and then to charge them tuition and fees, and that would be a source of revenue that hasn't been available to us in the past to complement the appropriated funds we receive from Congress. That's one example, and that, of course, was championed by the local congressional delegation.
Any final words on what's taking place at the Air Force Institute of Technology?
Well, we're about to start a new group of students here in August and September, and we're excited about that, bringing in another group that will spend, if they're in a master's program, 18 months with us, and in a doctoral program, 3 years with us, and we're excited about that. And so there will be, between our staff and this new crop of students, AFIT will have more than 1,000 people here in the Dayton community for some time, and we're excited about the opportunity of working with these folks.
I've been speaking with Dr. Todd Stewart, Chancellor of the Air Force Institute of Technology. Dr. Stewart, thanks for speaking with us today.
Glad to do it.
In this week's Politics Ohio, Treasurer Josh Mandel was in Troy this week to talk about jobs and Ohio's energy policy. Mandel is running against Senator Sherrod Brown in the November election. We talked to Karen Kassler with the Ohio State House News Bureau about campaign financing in the Senate race. Both sides are crying foul when it comes to the other party's spending.
Well, there's a lot of money in this race. There's no doubt this is one of the most watched U.S. Senate races in the nation. I mean, when you consider U.S. Senate races are unique in the fact that there are only 100 senators. It's a premier, prestigious position. The fact that Ohio's had two U.S. senators, one from each party, has been something that both parties have been very interested in looking at. I mean, Republicans look at this as an opportunity to seize a seat and take it away from the Democrats. Of course, Democrats look at it as a very necessary task to hold on to that seat and keep Sherrod Brown in office and make sure that state Treasurer Josh Mandel does not get elected. But, you know, that is the background for why there's so much money here. But you've got a lot of outside money in this race. There's about $10.5 million supposedly being spent against Sherrod Brown right now. But then Josh Mandel says that more money is going to be spent against him. That's a message that you're hearing, too, even President Obama talking about how he's going to be outspent. And so there may be a little bit of this underdog kind of thing coming in where candidates are appealing to their donors, especially as they get down further into the race where a lot of their early donors have given the max and they're exhausted and they have to appeal to new donors. This idea of I'm the underdog, I could lose if you don't donate, is something that I think you're seeing in a lot of different races. But there is just no doubt that this race, the Brown-Mandel race, is going to continue to be one of the leading races in the country in terms of the amount of money that's going to be spent, not only raised here in Ohio and spent here in Ohio, but from outside the state as well.
Kassler believes right now the GOP is heavily financing the Mandel campaign, but the money will even out as the race progresses.
Right now, it certainly seems that the outside groups that are aligned with Republican and conservative interests are spending more money in Ohio against Sherrod Brown. They're not necessarily spending money for Josh Mandel. They're spending money against Sherrod Brown. And in fact, a lot of these PACs, Karl Rove, the Republican operative, his PAC, American Crossroads GPS, is spending a ton of money on ads targeting Sherrod Brown. And then there's some other groups, the Chamber of Commerce groups have been spending some money against Sherrod Brown. But, you know, that's going to shift a little bit, too, as we get closer to the election. You're going to see groups that are more progressive, that are aligned with Democratic causes, spending money against Josh Mandel. That's just starting right now. I think only about $2.5 million has been spent against Josh Mandel. So, you know, it's going to even out a little bit more as we get closer to the race. But I think a lot of people are viewing this particular race as going to be really heavily sided toward the conservative groups and towards the money that's being spent against Sherrod Brown.
Both the Mandel and Brown campaigns are trying to score points from a Dayton Daily News article this week that suggested Mandel rarely opposed his party during his 4 years in the Ohio House, and that Sherrod Brown backed President Obama's agenda 95% of the time. That includes votes for Obamacare, a $453 billion tax hike, and cap-and-trade legislation. Karen Kassler suggests that by pushing the ideological stance of the other party, Mandel and Brown are appealing to independent voters.
A lot of independent voters, I think, view the parties as being more and more extreme and moving more and more to the left or to the right. And so an independent voter might be thinking, I feel this way about this issue, but I'm with the other party on this other issue. I want to find somebody that's in the middle. And, you know, that's a complaint we are hearing a lot, that it's hard to find who's in the middle anymore and who's working with the other party, who's a compromiser and a moderate. And so I think when you start accusing the other person of siding with their party all the time, you're suggesting that they are not a moderate, that they cannot compromise. And for some folks, that's a deal breaker.
Kassler says that current polls are favorable for both Sherrod Brown and the president, but there's plenty of time for things to change.
The polls right now are showing that Sherrod Brown is still leading. The most recent Quinnipiac poll showed that President Obama had a fairly significant lead, I think about 9 points over Mitt Romney. But I think there's a lot of people within the campaign that feel that's a little bit of an outlier right now, that the race is going to be closer than that. So right now, Sherrod Brown and President Obama both seem to have a lead. But again, there's 4 months until Election Day. And for even the pollster at Quinnipiac who did this poll said 4 months is a lifetime. So we've got a long way to go, which if you don't like ads and you really get tired of politics, this is going to be a really long year for you.
Karen Kassler with the Ohio State House News Bureau on this week's Politics Ohio.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of middle summer. When the cicadas sing at noon, then lanky ichneumons get into your house and sit on the walls like behemoth mosquitoes. Corn tassels and corn pollen are more plentiful when cicadas sing. Buckeyes and hickory nuts fall in thunderstorms. Goldenrod is 4 feet tall and lupin pods break apart and spread their seeds. White snakeroot, ironweed, boneset, wingstem, tall coneflowers and gray-headed coneflowers are budding in the fields and woods. as the pink large-flowered mallow comes to the end of its season in the wetlands. Midsummer hostas and liatris and obedient plants open in the garden. Blueweed flowers are at the top of their spikes during the early time of cicada song, just as the first burdock blooms. And fruit follows flowers. Black walnuts are half size. Green wild cherries hang in clusters. The shade-loving cohosh has its berries. Avens and thimble plants are forming seed heads under the canopy, and all the early honeysuckles have their berries, red and orange. Blackberries are August size this week, and the earliest are turning black. Elderberry bushes and ever-bearing strawberries set their fruit. The wheat is dark and almost half cut by the time cicadas sing. The oats crop ripens, milkweed pods emerge, and they will burst their shells at the approach of middle fall in late September. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of middle summer. In the meantime, watch for woolly bear caterpillars, the prophets of autumn, crossing the roads.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.